CosmicRadio.tv. This podcast would be nothing without our patrons, so special thanks goes out to them. Want to join their ranks and support independent content? Head to our Patreon at patreon.com/8bitlife. Welcome to the fine edition of my so-called 8-Bit Life. I'm your host, Roberto Vegas. Joining me today in studio, Jaime.
Hello.
Luis Avila.
Hello, hello.
That might be my favorite thing in Spanish culture that no one ever talks about.
Oh, yeah.
Is the fact that you're supposed to include your mother's maiden name.
Yes.
In your last name. Like mine would be Armora at the very end of mine, but it's one of those things that because like in the culture now of like hyphenated last names, I mean that would be what that would be. I guess
it's the other way around.
Yeah,
yeah. The hyphenated, they're doing it the opposite. So basically, your father's last name is the last one,
right? Exactly.
Which it makes more sense. It all started with the Romans, and they had like these weird naming conventions. Like for example, Julius Caesar was of the family Julii.
Right.
And I think his middle name was Caesar, and his first name was Gaius. So Gaius Caesar is his name of the Julii. So it's Julius Caesar.
Right.
Gaius Julius Caesar. So, yeah, in Spanish it continues, and in my passport, I have two last names.
Right.
And in my case, I only have one first name, but there's people who have, you know, a middle name.
Well, because mine would be, I may have a middle name, so I have four names total if I were to do it. That doesn't even include people that have, the one I've never quite understood, and I mean, it makes sense if you start to think of how, like, if you think of, like, how names kind of originated.
Right.
You know, the idea of a Smith would have been like, because you're a Smith or an X, Y, or Z in terms of that. Like my favorite one, I think, because it never translated out into English.
Right.
Well, I guess it did. Uh-huh. If you had because you never brought those up. Like for example, we don't have a people with last name, the Bruce.
Right.
You know, like. You
well,
know.
What
but, in, but in Spanish, you have, you know.
Del Valle.
Yeah. De la. Yeah, you know, of the blah.
Right. It's very interesting because it's what happens is that there's two ways you can get your name, or three. But one is you know, it's your father was blah, or your great-grandfather was a Smith or whatever.
Right.
But then there's also the noble origin name, which is usually a house or a city. So, for example, there's people who might be called Juan Perez del Valle, and del Valle would be, you know, kind of like that little bit.
Right.
The interesting thing is during, like, after independence in the Americas, everybody kind of erased their royal or noble connections because it sounded treacherous.
Yep.
And I think it also happened in the Americas a little bit, in the States a little bit, where anybody who had anything that was a little bit too English kind of got turned into...
Well, even in terms of, I mean, specifically the America, like...
Yeah.
Like, I'd imagine in Mexico, it became, my last name is Villegas.
Right.
And for those who do not know... I mean, for everybody, it's a Spanish last name in terms of being Mexican. It's actually a Spanish last name in terms of Spain.
Correct.
And I can imagine that my last name of Villegas may have held a little bit of different content when talking to, like, Sancho Panza, you know,
Juan Perez.
Not even that. Oh, God, what's his fucking name? He was, like, you know, hung out with Hemingway, like, one of my favorite authors. Revolutionary Mexico.
Castro?
No, not Castro. I mean,
you mean Pancho Villa?
Yeah, Pancho Villa.
Right.
Patron saint of alcoholics.
Yeah. No, exactly. There was this thing where.
But to kind of give a quick thing to people who are not Mexican, do not know Mexican history in any capacity. To give a quick thing of who Pancho Villa was, whenever you think in your head of the stereotypical Mexican, the image people are conjuring is Pancho Villa with the bandoliers, everything,
and then the big mustache, and the sombrero,
and again, not because
Pancho Villa had many children,
yes,
and many wives,
yeah. I think the joke,
but he loved them all,
yep,
and he married them all.
Oh yeah, no, I think the joke is like one of my friends. I think my friend we always joked was because the way he looked was that he had that his relatives that he was like great descendant was Pancho Villa. I think everybody from Mexico at one point in time,
yeah, no,
traced their lineage to Pancho Villa.
It's so interesting. Everybody wants it, like, and before independence, you know, before 1820s and yeah. The Americas, everybody traced their heritage to some, you know, nobleman in Spain. So everybody had, you know, found that they were related to somebody, and
right.
They kind of connected.
Well, because a lot of times what would happen, especially when it came to lineage, because lineage is that weird thing that, you know, I think it's become bigger now.
Yeah.
Not because of the idea of where you came from, but more of that with the advent of sort of like if you think about
genetic testing and stuff,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the idea of DNA,
yeah.
and DNA is very much a like it's not a I guess a modern day concept in terms of the grand scheme mm-hmm, of things, mm-hmm. but it's become more of a modern day idea for the
yeah.
Like it went like DNA has been known since like what
1949 I think
right
or 50. 51,
but only
like that.
Maybe in the last what 30 years, maybe less.
DNA testing?
Well, because
25 years.
Okay, because
yeah.
That was the idea. You know, like when
I remember the first like big deal case.
Right, exactly. That's so. What I'm trying to say is that DNA.
And I'm not that old.
Well, that's ultimately what I'm trying to get at is that only in recent times have we gotten the idea of DNA
yeah.
being this sort of
and,
marker of who you are.
And it was very expensive.
Yes.
So, and only recently can you just get, you know, what is it, 26andMe and,
yeah,
and,
exactly.
and that sort of thing. And just and what I find fascinating, and I'm very happy about this, because, you know, what you think of as a Latin American might be an idea, but it in reality is it's like the States. It's
right.
Every single, you know, racial heritage, you know, religion is in Latin America, and what's happening with the, all these genetic testing is people are discovering that that you know their identity is multifaceted.
Yep.
And that's fantastic, because even the most pure. Mayflower person has not 100% English blood in him. He has some Irish and maybe
well, yeah,
some French.
Because there's like it's
if you go back enough. You
well, because it's one of those things of that you just. I mean, if everybody
that's,
fucked
that's
everybody.
Wonderful.
Let's just put it
yes.
that way. Everybody fucked everybody.
Everybody fucked everybody.
I mean, even you know
and,
Jefferson
and,
fucked his slaves. As bad as that sounds.
Very interesting. I found because I kind of pursued Jefferson is a I have this big debate with my daughter who's a big fan of Hamilton the musical.
Right.
And she's, you know, 100% pro Hamilton.
It could be you could be a fan of the musical and
right.
still question Jefferson.
No, of course, but she's pro Hamilton and I'm pro Jefferson because in the federal debate I prefer Jefferson's side. In the Federalist.
So you're anti-bank.
Anti-centralized government, whatever.
Anti-central banks. All the stuff that you know, modern society takes for granted.
A little bit.
You know.
But I like him because I think Jefferson is a geek, like 100%. Like he just built stuff and I like his Bible.
The right term, but okay.
No, but
I'll let it slide.
I'm trying to find out about this. This is a very interesting fact. Jefferson's wife died, right?
Right.
And Sarah Heming was half sister to his wife, and she was actually the daughter of of another person that was half African. So in the end, how did it work? The interesting thing is that Jefferson had gotten into a lot of trouble because he proposed to free the slaves very early, and everybody in Virginia kind of almost disowned him and threw him away, and
right.
he got in trouble. So he basically never talked about abolition ever again. But he kept it, and I think he actually loved this person, and he gave his name to all the kids, by the way, and they actually founded. There's a Jefferson family,
yeah, that is
connected, and they're, I hate to say it, but they're white. They're all because Sarah was very very she was a quarter African basically, she was beautiful, I'm sure.
It's
and she was said to be the splitting image of Jefferson's dead wife.
I'll put it this way,
which is weird.
Everybody, if we talk about, the
so gene pool, it's not like he went out into the fields and found his.
No, what I'm trying to get at is that.
But old people are weird. Like olden times guys, they did weird shit.
Right.
A lot.
What I'm trying to get at is when I say everyone fucked everybody.
But everybody fucked everybody.
It's more of the idea that, if we talk about genetics,
yes,
and the gene pool,
yes,
and everything at large when it comes to that. A lot of things and this is going to get sciencey, so if you happen to be a person that is of a persuasion
if
that
science is evil,
right,
this get
may
out.
Not, yeah, this may not be the show for you today. This may not be the podcast for you if you've kind of come around in Twitch land.
If science is bad, this
might not be your show. That's okay. But
if science is bad, what are you doing watching Twitch?
I don't know. There's got to be some Catholic streamers out there, there has to be the hardcore evangelical game streamers streaming for the Lord. Yeah. Maybe that's what an audience I should be pitching to. It's
Electrons for the Lord.
The holy streamers.
Yeah.
Like the holy rollers from Simpsons.
Yes, yes.
But going back to the idea of science and sort of like that.
Right. Science and
screwing. You talk about the idea of the gene pool, the mission of it is to get as much diversity as possible.
Yes.
In other words, for survival of the race, for survival of, yes, of everything else, you want to have as much diversity as possible, because the more diversity you have, the higher chances you have of
surviving plagues,
right, of getting rid of defects, weeding that sort of stuff,
yes,
out because of just the nature of overpowering genes and they combine. And so, everybody at a certain point, if you've gotten this far, if your lineage has gotten this far, if you as a human – as part of a lineage of other ones in terms of like whether it be the Viegases or
that,
all these sort of things, chances are somewhere in the chain somebody fucked somebody of another,
yes,
genome.
Well, yes and no. Because
another human genome.
Here's the interesting thing, and I apologize, but I see there's nobody watching just yet.
Oh, there's one. It's okay.
There's one.
Just keep talking.
So I'll talk about race. Here's the thing about race. Race doesn't exist. There is general locations where you're from, and there's certain populations that are more or less in this area.
I won't go as far as say race doesn't exist. I think I know where you're getting at. The idea of, if you take the idea of here's a human being,
right,
and this is again breaking down to science. Take the idea of human being. There are certain traits that are, I guess, exemplified.
Right.
Genetically,
but let me give you an idea. I think that,
for example, in terms of and this is just science. This is not anything bad. I know we're touching on it.
This is just science.
If you take the idea of certain regions of the oceanic,
right,
the Oceania area.
But here's the thing.
Exemplify slant. I forgot what the term is for the.
They have an epicanthic fold. They have a little bit more skin
on the.
But let me tell you, this is the thing. Race in humans is very similar to speciation in other animals. Basically, if you separate this type of porpoise,
right,
if you have all these dolphins and you separate a bunch and you put them over here, they start developing different traits that have to do with that particular location.
Right.
And then when you bring them back, they're different, and sometimes they can't mate and they can't have offspring. So like, for example, the donkey and the horse,
right,
they come from the same stock at some point, and then they grew up in different areas. There was no horses in the Americas, and So they can't really create a child. They created mules, but the mules are sterile.
Humans, because
well, it was going that way. We all, and again, if you don't believe in science, I'm sorry. It's you okay. don't have to.
That's just like, yeah,
science is just
this
is
one of the, again. This is one of the you know.
But we all came from Africa at the same time, more or less the same time.
Yes,
and so that's modern humans, and we are more or less the same. And then a group went back to Africa, which is interesting. They actually went back, and a group went to Asia and to to
and
to Europe.
In terms of
theoretically, and we now understand the European contingent kind of mated with Neanderthals,
right?
And we get a lot of like Neanderthal traits, you know, big noses,
and
stuff like this. However, we were going in the direction of separate species, and you could cut it in three, basically, you know, Africans, Europeans, and Asians.
Right.
And everything else is a mixture of that, right?
Correct.
And then something interesting happened. About 500 years ago, the distances and the differences between us humans went away when we started having transoceanic travel. And some people say it happened before, but the second you start doing that, the barriers between these peoples go away. And so we have been in the last 500 years, 600 years, in a process of reversing speciation. So what used to be this very clear line, which was, you know, somewhat arbitrary. For example, the white man, for example, that word has to do with people coming. Like, it usually means Europeans.
Right, exactly.
But Europeans are many and varied. And depending on where you're from, that European, like if it's an explorer that goes to South America,
keep going.
That European is a Spaniard or a Portuguese. But if it's going to North America, he's either French or English.
Right.
But I honestly believe that in the last, you know, 500 years, and even more so in the last 300, 400 years, where you have railroads and steamers and stuff like this, all that stuff has gone away. And what you end up with is basically a relatively varied mix of people. But there's a great show that has to do with these genetic tests you know, somebody lives in Hong Kong from a traditional Chinese family, and somebody who lives in I think it was Norway, and so forth and so on. And you realize that they have genes from places, you know, far away. And that's because in the final analysis, genes are fighting it out. And what, you know, we think as humans want to survive and, you know, want to have more children and whatnot. No. The gene wants to spread.
Right. That's the idea.
And they're individual genes. So, for example, if you have a gene that is you know, for good vision or whatever, that gene wants to be in as many individuals as possible because it means it's continuation of it, its information.
Right.
And so you, as time goes by, the most successful genes kind of get grouped into the most successful individuals. And that means that not only will there be fucking, but also science.
This is probably the sexiest science ever gets people.
No, but also it means that the lines are fuzzy. And they're fuzzy because of biology.
Well, I mean, that's the idea. I mean, like, if you joke, you know, the joke has always been that as humans start, you know, procreating amongst the races, and I put that in quotes because, you know, because some, you could argue that yes, race exists, but it's more of, you know,
culture exists.
What I'm trying to say is that race is more of a cultural thing.
Ethnicity, exactly.
Right. It's more of a cultural thing versus anything else.
Yes.
And I think that's important to talk about because.
Absolutely. You know, and that's a real thing.
Right.
And you're from.
We all kind of just start screwing, you know, fucking each other. We're eventually going to become just gray blobs.
Yes.
You know?
Gray blobs. However, this gray blob is going to like salsa music, and this gray blob over here is going to like polka because that's the culture group.
Right, exactly.
That's where I come from.
That's just what the gray blobs do in in Minnesota versus the gray blobs in California.
Right, right.
You know, and that's fine. I think
actually, I don't think we're going to be gray blobs. I think we're going to be Brazilian. So we're all going to be like sexy ass,
totally
hot.
I think that's a totally fine thing.
Like golden, you know.
Well, because like I have friends that like will watch like the Brazilian like model contest,
dude,
just for the asses on,
dude. It is.
You're
amazing.
A married man. I'm single. I can say these.
I'm a married man. I will not ever partake, but I can watch, dude. But yeah, no. In general, I think what defines us as people nowadays is more of our culture than
yes.
anything else.
Yeah,
and the culture is no longer even associated with a geographic area. Like for example, chat realms in general, we are culturally bound.
That's been something I've been thinking about often, only because, especially with me in nerdcore and me in a lot of these other sort of areas.
Yeah.
I was talking with Chris Allen IQ about this. It's been a thought that's sort of been in my head. The idea that, you know, a lot of the common ground I have with people of my generation,
mm-hmm.
I say that is that because, again, if we think about, you know, I grew up in different sort of cultures like that and
right.
I grew up different ideas and even different kind of backgrounds. Yes, I'm Hispanic. Yes,
yeah, yeah.
I had, you know, I'm a Catholic, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, I didn't grow up in the barrio. I grew up in a fucking suburb in Flint and Grand Blanc.
Yep.
You know, I grew up in a very, you know, nice and kind of thing. And I have friends who their background wasn't quite that either, or
right.
was that. But the things that we have as a common vernacular, especially in kind of geekdom, is video games for me.
Yep.
And sort of this like weird nerd culture where I can kind of bring up these sort of things. And I've been thinking about the idea of, especially as it happens now, because I thought about this, I was in Japan this past, last year, and sort of seeing all these kind of people at the Chiptunes concert that I was like, yeah, I'm talking with Australians and we're just kind of having a go. And some of the random guy from New York was there and I could have a conversation with some of the people from Japan. And, you know, you go to these other stores and kind of feel at home.
Absolutely.
Well, because a lot of times, and I think what's happened with the advent of the internet is that a lot of people of this generation, and not everybody, because there's some people that don't, but we have kind of a common vernacular of certain
mm-hmm.
things, especially when you talk to geeks, you know,
yeah.
in terms of that. We have sort of, we may not necessarily share all this exact same interest in geekdom in terms of like, you know.
We might not know it. We might not
right.
recognize it.
Right. Well, that's what sort of the idea. Like for me, I have certain sort of interests, and if I don't know of an interest, I'll ask questions about it, and then most of the time, if I come correct, they'll explain and they're willing to share.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times it becomes a sort of, this is my lingua franca, you know,
right.
this is my way of communicating.
This is your common tongue.
Right. Well, because I can say certain things, I can bring up certain facts, and even if
yeah.
some of the words got lost, if I say these three key words here, someone goes, oh, yes,
right.
mother, or,
right.
oh,
yeah.
you know, there's certain kind of things. Like for me, I'll always say anime as sort of thing, especially with that, and I'll say, you know, there's an anime that I always use as an example depending on who I'm talking
mm-hmm.
to, and I'll say it's Saint Seiya is in the Japanese one, and the American version is sort of this the idea being that you have these warriors of the zodiac.
Okay, yeah,
but
yeah.
What I give as the Spanish one, for people who are Mexican, I go, you may know it as Caballeros del Zodiaco, because I know that for a fact.
Caballeros del Zodiaco, yeah.
I know that because of everything I know of being
yes,
part of that culture.
It's super
you know,
big.
You know, going back, you know, living.
It's younger than me,
yeah.
but it is.
Well, again, I had cousins,
giant.
I had, cousins that had,
yeah.
had all the.
And that is.
That had toys that like current collectors
in
would scream.
All of Latin
at.
America, by the way.
Exactly. And, that's
and it
I
goes
can,
to
right.
Antarctica.
And so I can bring that up, or I can
yeah.
bring up the idea of like, you
and,
know. If,
and
you
with
know.
Me, it was Transer Z, for example.
Right.
Which is Messenger Seto or Messenger C. And that's something that crosses culture. But I think there's something new. There's something new in geekdom that is a greater culture builder. And like, for example, because if you like chess, yeah, you can
yeah.
meet other people that talk chess and stuff
right,
like that.
Right, exactly.
But it is a limited part of your life. But for some reason, I think that if you like video games, there's certain other things, not just the game. There's the culture around it, but there's
yep.
also the equipment.
Yeah.
There's also the time at which things – there's a –
You know, these games came out at this time, so it kind of links a generation together as well. And I think that those are things that build culture a little bit stronger. And I find it fascinating because I've had a chance to travel and talk to different nerds in different places. I find it fascinating how linked we are to different generations. So like in general, for example, it has to do with the computer that you played your games first, or the when you got into technology, which equipment you were working on, or whatever. And for example, when I read Ready Player One, there's a lot of mentions of the color TRS-80. I basically learned to program in a color TRS-80, so it hit me very strongly, and it was really interesting that a lot of people that were reading it also had that connection, including Ernie Cline.
Funny it was for me, because like I have just recently finally, like, for me, gaming began at the Nintendo, and PC began in the disk operating system of the, you know, 386,
right.
But
so you King's know, Quest and that sort of thing.
Right. You know, I began my video game journey then. But in hindsight, you know, looking at certain things, like there was a recent documentary, Viva Amiga, talking about the Amiga computer.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I know why I never owned an Amiga, because my parents never spent that kind of money on me. Not because they would spend money on me, but because it's like...
It was also not as popular as people think.
Well, it was popular in Europe. And the thing is, like, I know... Like, it's funny. I didn't learn about the Amiga until I'd gone to a boarding school, and there was a exchange student from Australia.
Right.
My friend Cameron. And he would sing the praises of the Amiga. And he would tell me about this system. There's this magical thing called the Amiga.
Yes.
And I'd ask him all these questions about it, because I'm like, I'm curious what the hell this is. And what it, you know, this is, you know, the Amiga had been dead for a while since then.
Right.
But he would tell me about the system and about these things. And then you start to learn, you know, then I get in the demo scene, and then I get into mods, and I start learning about this other thing called the Amiga. Like, what the fuck is this Amiga thing? And then I do my research, and I'm like, oh, cool. And it wasn't until maybe... I'd like to say like 5 years, 6 years that I even knew about what Video Toaster was.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as I look into it more, I'm like, man, I kind of wish I had an Amiga back then, because I would have just been doing, you know, I would have been doing what I do now on the Amiga and had like light years ahead. Like I would have already been ready for, you know, come the day things are cheaper.
It's really interesting, the Video Toaster. I remember when I first saw some stuff produced in the Video Toaster, and it looked like magic. It's so weird how... Your brain will adapt to an aesthetic,
right,
and will recognize it as much better than, you know, what came before, and give it a value. But like, I've tried to rewatch some of the Babylon 5 stuff, and it's hard.
No, B5 is one of those things that, and for those, this is science fiction, Babylon 5 TV show. Babylon 5 is one of the shows that I think made a very critical mistake.
Yeah,
in that.
It was cheap, supposedly,
well,
right?
Well, I say the critical mistake, because this is where the critical mistake came down to it, I think, in my opinion. 3D graphics, fine. That could have failed. That could have not looked – obviously not going to look hot years later. That's fine. What it did wrong, and I almost wished it didn't do this, was because there's a very famous shot in that show that I love, and that shows exactly what was wrong with Babylon 5.
Okay.
And it's
we're going to debate a little bit because I like it, but
it shows exactly what's wrong with it,
okay,
and why it's so hard to watch it now. I think President Sherman, the guy, Sherman,
sure.
So he's giving
Sheridan.
He's giving an address of some sort to the
masses, the accumulated masses,
the promenade.
I'm kidding.
Whatever the I say the promenade, that's ZNS is
right. The Zócalo.
The Zócalo. Okay. And,
Roberto.
And so, yes. And so one shot of it is the crowd in the bazaar.
Right.
And they're all, and it's on a soundstage somewhere doing its thing.
Right.
And it looks real and it looks like a set.
Uh-huh.
And it looks fine. You know, it's not the fanciest of sets, but, you know, neither was the Promenade of Deep Space Nine.
Right.
Neither were any of those sets.
Yes, they were basically the size of this room, and they just shot it from...
It did a good job. It did a great job of making the bizarre. You know, it's on a soundstage somewhere in Los Angeles or where they filmed it. That's cool. I think it's one of the better shots that sets that thing, and I think it works.
Yeah.
The other shot was behind a green screen.
Yeah.
And...
It's very obviously behind a green screen.
Well, it's just it's not even like space. It's like this weird, it's this weird thing of like, I understand why you're doing this as a shot, but it is so jarring between the two shots. Like
one
is like this physical set, and the other one's that. And I think like when I say the thing that was wrong with Babylon 5, not because Babylon 5 is a bad show. I think Babylon 5 is actually a very strong show, and I think there's some moments in that show that are great, like with especially when it came to Lux or what was his name? The essentially the Machiavellian equivalent race with the hair.
Oh, the
I've read the character's name.
Yeah, no, this Centauri.
Yeah, there's some great, you know, great characters in that show and great races.
The Centauri.
It does a great job of that. Like, I think story-wise, it's strong. And I think it could hold up today if they ever reboot it.
It is.
But the thing that's so hard is that they had... I don't know what writer made that call. Like, what... Because I can imagine Fox basically said, like, we have this all this fucking technology. We better fucking use this shit.
Well,
because you look at Deep Space Nine...
Right, but the main difference, I think, is that Deep Space Nine was
Paramount.
Yeah. It was a syndication model that was, you know, successful and retried. It also, Deep Space Nine had much more money because we were hungry for Trek.
Right. And again, I think it's
the original, Next Generation had gone away.
Well, TNG had worked. And that's
right.
TNG worked. And we
Deep
more.
Space Nine... excuse me. Babylon 5 had budget problems almost from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And so you see that, and it's regrettable. And if you see, like, the last season, there was, I think it moved from sci-fi to TNT or from TNT to sci-fi.
Yeah.
And all that stuff kind of hurt it. However, like Doctor Who, some of that stuff, it kind of made up in writing.
It was written really well. Again, it's a great show. Again, the issue I have with it is like that shot in particular, just because it highlighted, like, man, if they had just like decided to as opposed to making it pure, like, in other words, as opposed to making a pure green screen shot, just, you know,
I
basically think, built like this, like false, you know, you know, put fucking windows and portals.
Yeah,
like,
I think
like that could go a long way.
I think at some point they were having a lot of green screen because they thought, well, we're going to fix this in post a lot. And then the money wasn't there for fixing it. But I think Babylon 5 is a great candidate for the treatment that they did with the original series, Star Trek, the original series, where they redid all of the effect shots,
right?
And it looks
they had luck of like they had the plate still for those,
right?
They could
up-res them. But I remember watching the original series, and I remember every planet being like a purple blob, or an orange blob,
the soundstage they had.
Yes, and
or they could just go to the desert and film some stuff, go on location,
and they changed it, and now it looks amazing, and it still has that you know, kind of navy gray, you know, aesthetic, but you can accept it as a you know, an element of that era, which can happen because, you know, I've seen my parents in this weird ass late 60s, early 70s garb that, you know, looks like made up, you know, all these big bell bottoms.
A lot of it is that, again, it's hard to, when you do any kind of graphics, to have that hold up.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of those.
Yeah,
sort of
the problem I have with Babylon 5 is that some of the early shots were done in the video toaster.
Right.
And they show, and you know, astronauts are blocky and
see,
however.
My issues I have with video with Babylon 5 is that it was at that era of Fox.
Yeah.
Where where they had more influence over their programs.
Yeah, okay.
Like one of my favorite episodes of Babylon 5 is Sheridan is basically talking about these magicians.
Oh, the Technomage?
Not the Technomage. No. Technomages are tired. Technomage is a different story. No, no. I'm talking about honest to God fucking performing magicians.
They're comedians.
They're comedians. That's
they're not magicians.
And it's fucking Penn and fucking Teller.
It's Rebo and Zooty.
Right. And let me tell you, having Penn and Teller come out in anything pulls you out of that experience, whether it be Babylon 5, whether it be Hackers, or whatever. Because Penn and Teller are so fucking Penn and Teller.
Yes.
They belong in their own universe. You know, they are Penn and Teller.
I love that episode. Especially. The best part of that episode is I think, as
well,
a setup.
Because the Penn and Zuki thing are like, it's like just like weird beeline.
Yeah, but they had mentioned Rebo and Zooty like 20 times, yeah. And they had to show them. But I think as a setup for this episode, they have, because there's a period where I think they were going to spin off like a court, like Space Court TV or something.
Oh, yeah.
So they had like this there's this Space Court, and there's these Terrans who are suing these gray aliens because their ancestors came and molested them. It was awesome. And the gray alien is like, you know. And your ancestors maliciously came to Earth.
Well, because the thing is, like, Babylon 5 had so many kind of cool things. It had the shadow. It had the fucking, what was it that, the psyops?
Psycor.
The Psycor with Chekhov. Which I can't remember the actor's name, but I feel terrible saying his T and his.
Koenig.
Koenig, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he was
Walter
just like,
Koenig.
Walter Koenig was just like, because of fucking Psycor. It was like
oh, he was great.
No, and again, he was.
He was deliciously evil. Well, he was
Deep Space Nine didn't really touch on that, and the next generation sort of modern Trek genre didn't touch on that concept of Psycor, or even the idea of having
limitations on telepaths and stuff.
Anyways, it doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. But kind of going back to the whole idea of that. It's one of those things of like, man, there are certain moments of Babylon 5 that are that I think are stellar writing. Like, especially, you know, the idea of Babylon 5 being the last best hope of mankind, because, you know, Babylon 1 through 3 failed and 4 got warped into the stratosphere.
I want to know where the budget came to keep building these things.
Oh, that was just a desperate attempt of like they had it like I almost want to believe that budget was the same budget that happened in terms of Battlestar Galactica that they had to have like the mission with the toasters. We'll meet here every so often in the Demilitarized Zone. Somebody here to say hi. One's here. Cool. We're gonna head out back home. Just in case they come back home and say they do something.
Yeah, no, and also you can imagine that if Earth had very little money, diplomacy was a way to kind of not fight wars.
Right.
So they would spend money on the space station. And also, theoretically, the space station was going to pay for itself because they could sell space to other people.
Right.
Still, if the first one blows up mysteriously, the second one blows up mysteriously, the third one disappears fucking mysteriously.
That's one of those weird ones of like, I almost want to believe that was just a weird writing. Like, why would you bother with that?
You have to remember that the Bible was written by Harlan Ellison, who Trek fans. He wrote the City on the Edge of Forever, which is one of the best Trek episodes ever of all time, in my opinion. It's the one with the Guardian of Forever, which is this donut surrounded in mist, and you go through it and you travel in time. Let him be.
And
he wrote the Bible, and Harlan Ellison is I very much respect him as a sci-fi writer. And so I think that
it was going to be addressed at some point, but they didn't.
Well, didn't they do an episode of that? Like, didn't they have like the whole like we found B4?
Oh, right. No, B4 is actually spoilers, but B4 is traveling in time.
Right, that's what it was.
And you can make a case that that you know the Earthers or the Terrans or I don't remember what they're called in this particular thing knew that they had to do it, that there was some sort of a cosmic loop going on, and so you had some people behind the scenes kind of making sure that gets done. So yeah, I guess you could, but it was never actually written. It was never you never went into it. It just happened that you know they kept rebuilding them.
Because I think the reason why and why Babylon 5 was the last one, because I bet that it was like, all right, this is our last attempt to try to, because again, it was the trick of Babylon 5, much like Deep Space Nine was, much like all these sort of things, and this is sort of, you know, the joke has always been that Deep Space Nine was Trek's answer to Babylon 5.
Yes, absolutely.
But the idea behind...
Well, the other way around, right?
No, Babylon 5 came well before Deep
Space Nine. Correct. Deep Space Nine was made in the image of Babylon 5.
Right, that was a joke, and there's, you know, there's definitely differences between the two. I think the Cardassians are way better. You know,
Cardassians. Yes, I'm sorry. I keep mispronouncing.
You know, the Cardassians existed well before, the
Cardassians,
and they exist in TNG time,
right?
But they became, you know, way more prominent in Deep Space Nine to the point where you had, you know, because again, I love Sisko and. What's his face?
Odo?
No, not Odo. That's
Quark.
Like, not Quark. Oh, fuck. It was Sisko and who was the Cardassian?
Gul Dukat.
Like love Sisko and Dukat's, you know,
dynamic.
Dynamic. It's one of my. I think it's one of my favorite. Like if you think of you know the you know if you think of like prior ones, it would have been you know Picard and Borg, or even later ones would have been Janeway and the Borg, and sort of other ones. Like Dukat was,
he is
one of my all time favorite like villains in that whole series because he went from
I like the Domain.
Well, the Dominion's cool.
Dominion,
but I loved the Domain. I loved Dukat because he went from all right,
like
I'm doing
adversary.
This. Well, because what I liked about Dukat as a character is that you know he said I do this for my people.
Yes,
I do everything for my people, and then his people sort of abandoned him. And it came to the end of like, I don't do this for my people.
No, I'm doing it for myself.
This has always been for me.
It's all about me.
And I love that I love that like that he deluded himself.
There's an honesty to that character.
I love that he deluded himself and he got to the point of like, I do this for the good of Cardassian.
Right.
It's like, nuh-uh, you do this for yourself. And I loved at the end just like him talking to like the other alien, you know, the anti-founders and like working with that and spinning religion and doing all these sort of really nefarious things, and then getting to the point where he's calling like he's calling like Major Kira and showing just how you know broken her life was and everything that she thought was a lie and destroying every image of her mother and just reveling in this fact of being a complete and utter asshole.
Yeah,
and it's one of my favorite like all the moments I have of Deep Space Nine are my favorite ones of that. Like you know, there's a really good episode. I think it's near like the last season where because like where Deep Space Nine excelled, I think, is
with not Dax.
Where Deep Space Nine excelled, much like where Babylon 5 excels, is when you drop the facade. I mean, if we talk about you know Star Trek, you know the original series, and TNG kind of touches on this to a certain degree. Started going away from it, but the idea of dropping the facade that everything is perfect. You know, because that was only because like one of my favorite episodes of two of my favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine, but one of them in particular is basically it kicks off with Sisko doing a captain's log, you know, a captain's log,
right?
And he's doing it on basically telling how he got the Romulans and the Vulcans and everybody on board to start attacking to be part of the war. And he pulled some shady stuff. like you look at that, it is like super freaking dark of
yes.
how he manipulated and did the facts all in the name
yes.
of making sure that we win this war. And it's one of the most powerful episodes of that character, and one yep. of the most like moments, because it's like at the end of the log, he's like, and you know what? I don't regret a damn thing. You know, essentially, I don't regret a damn thing.
Yeah.
Computer, delete that whole thing.
Yeah.
No one's going to hear any of this shit. And it's such a pimp fucking move.
There is something that would have never been possible if you know the big bird of the galaxy was alive. If Roddenberry had been around.
Oh, yeah. Roddenberry would never have let that slide. And I'm so glad that,
yeah.
May God rest his soul. Everything,
yeah, yeah.
You believe that? I mean, I believe that kind of stuff. You know, everything else. But, man. Deep
right.
Space Nine
because
is like because you think of TNG, like, began as just sort of like, we got to keep up with the whole – we got to keep the whole Star Trek thing going. You know, we got to do all those sorts of stuff.
Right. And also in TNG, Star Trek is an ideal. You know,
right.
it's what all races should aspire to. It, Starfleet is an absolute good. The Federation is the best
right.
possible form of government and whatnot. And it's the role, at least in the first three seasons, of the Enterprise crew to show to the galaxy just how awesome and how wonderful being part of the Federation is, and how important and just goddamn good Starfleet is.
Right.
And Picard is being called to mediate between all kinds of other species and because, you know, there's all this moral authority of the Federation. And I think in Deep Space Nine, it's like, no. Absolute power.
You know, after Roddenberry passed and sort of I forgot who the showrunner was after that point.
Because
he became the showrunner for Deep Space Nine as well. I forget the guy's name, and I feel bad.
Braga?
Yeah, I think so. I'll have to double check, but it's okay for now.
Yep.
But the point being is you started seeing the concept, like, and I think it's one of my favorite TNG tropes,
mm-hmm.
and modern day Star Trek tropes.
Right.
Is the idea is once you become admiral, somewhere along the line, the ideology flips to like, no, we know how to run this. I love the idea of the evil admiral, because it's such a common trope in any modern day Star Trek, from the episode where I think it's you know, Riker and the Pegasus,
uh-huh.
and his admiral's like, we got to get the, because they basically had the first ever Federation made cloaking device that also metaphysics shielding where you could metaphasic cloaking where you could like travel through matter
and
stuff, and it's one of those things that just like it breaks every treaty they have.
Yeah.
I love the idea of that. Or you go down, you know, the Deep Space Nine route.
Zone, schmucho zone.
You know, who cares? let's just pull this. Let's
we're
the Federation.
It's not my favorite episode, but one of the things that I remember, and I saw this when I was, I was maybe 16, 17. So I was Will Wheaton's age, basically.
Yes.
Although Will Wheaton is older than me, and I will never, you know, forget that. because he looks awesome.
Well, he was in Stand By Me.
Yeah. So there's this one episode where Picard gets some calls to meet other captains in these asteroids.
Yes.
And and it's like outside channels and stuff, and eventually you trace this like parasite all the way to Starfleet Command, and there's this like super strong. It's now that if you see it now, like the effects are kind of wonky.
Oh, right. The McCarthyism era. Well, there's
yeah,
there's a lot
but
of
there's
those.
There's this. This animal that comes from the center of the this guy,
right?
And they just freaking go full blast on their phases, and it just explodes. I that floored me. I'm like, phasers make people explode?
Well, why not? No one ever put it on kill and see what happens.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, keep this sucker on stun. It's like, no, we cranking this sucker up, because again, and I liked that they started doing that, and then come Deep Space Nine, they just you know, kind of
ramped it up,
and there's certain moments in Deep Space Nine where, especially when the War of the Dominion kicks off,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, or changelings kick in, which are talking about, you know, all these kind of things.
It does. The only problem I have with Deep Space Nine is that for some reason, and I know comparisons are not fair, but Babylon 5, there's always stuff happening, because, and you can see people coming and going because of the way interstellar travel happens with these
right.
with jump gates. So you can see that that's like a place where people would come and get into another gate, and so it was a junction. It was an off ramp.
Well, you know why Deep Space Nine or Terok Nor was was such an important thing, right? It had nothing to do with the fact. I mean, in the early day, in the history of it, it was obviously a Cardassian mining colony and taking care, you know, doing Bajor. But the kicker for why Deep Space Nine was such a good such a thing for the Federation
mm-hmm.
was because of the wormhole.
Oh, of course,
the wormhole into the
Delta Quadrant.
Delta Quadrant. At that point. Was it out? Because we're in the Alpha, they were in the Delta,
and Voyager will be in the Gamma.
Yeah, exactly, Gamma Quadrant. Yeah, and that was why it was seen. This is where we're all, you know, this is why Commander Sisko at the time was stationed there, was because it was seen as a military thing, and at, you know, this is now we're almost out of time here. We're digging deep in Deep Space Nine, but because this is
right.
The
and,
reason why Commander Sisko was brought to Deep Space Nine was because he had survived Wolf 359,
right?
And he had fought valiantly against the Borg, and so like, well you're a military person, you belong here because this is not a military outpost.
Right.
Yeah, you're just gonna be
here for a while.
But like, yeah, it has the illusion of being a peaceful thing, but this is military. This is why you're here.
There's two things,
and because the Bajorans respect military,
right?
And you're gonna team up with this Major Kira,
right? Which who I think was going to be Ensign Ro originally. The idea was Ensign Ro would be Kira, but she's obviously the prototype for the the angry fighting Bajoran.
But we had to have somebody be me. We had to somehow work in the Maquis. We have to set those stones up quickly.
There's three things I like about Babylon 5 that I don't have to do necessarily with it. I like the fleshing out of the. The Ferengi. I love it. I really like it.
He said Babylon 5, by the way.
Deep Space Nine. I love the way, because the Ferengi in TNG were these like cartoonish, oafish.
They gave a lot more depth. They explained certain things and even gave some of the characters tour de forces
and a little bit too much warlike, more than they should have been in the first.
Well, especially in Deep Space Nine, they gave with
Quark
with Rom.
Rom, Quark.
Who was his son? Nog. Like Nog.
Yes, they were three dimensional.
Well, that's what was cool about what I liked about Nog was that especially there's a moment. Before he joins, you know, he takes a test to join Starfleet and go to the Academy. There's a very powerful moment where he's talking with Sisko, Commander. I don't know, Captain at the point, trying to get his recommendation, and he goes.
He tries to bribe him,
which is bribes. Does everything that typically a Ferengi would do.
Yeah,
and he comes and he goes. He's like, "Why do you want to do this? Is Nog? Because I don't want to end up like my dad."
Yep.
And it's this very powerful moment of like that his dad that talking about his dad, how he respects him, how he could have been he could have been something more.
Yeah,
but he didn't.
Yeah, and he comes from a culture where
he was a good for, and I love the idea of him saying because he was a good Ferengi, and this whole thing of like I'm tired of being what people call good.
And he comes from,
and it was such a powerful scene.
And he comes from a culture that doesn't respect techs as much as it should.
Right.
And you know. It respects, you know, the businessman,
it was a good character moment for everybody, but definitely a good character moment for Nog, because again, it was such a, you know, very powerful scene. Like a lot of those characters had. I think that's what I liked ultimately more about Deep Space Nine, even though I liked the movie 5, is that everybody had those strong character moments.
Right. I also like. The way
it wouldn't be until Voyager that we'd have a Garibaldi kind of quirk of like watching old TV media stuff.
Yeah. I also like that in DS9, they actually straddle the line between religion and science in a very interesting way. Like
with the founders
and the
prophets.
Right, the prophets.
Or the space aliens or the wormhole.
Right, the wormhole aliens.
Right.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Kira knows perfectly well that they're wormhole aliens.
Right.
And yet she can respect her own religious tradition, she knows that they guide the development of her culture. There's a lot of
interesting things, and I think like really where it becomes bizarre and strange in that series was when they started introducing the concept of the orbs. These sort of like things that had grander purposes, especially like not just simply being these like very advanced technological devices in terms of that. Oh, this one actually is good travel through time,
right?
And it wouldn't. And the thing is, what was cool about those moments, about those devices, was it wasn't that like you could go back and really fix anything,
no,
because it already happened. And even it showed of like things of like no one ever fixed anything. Like when Kira went back to look at her mother, it's not like she did everything that was already going to happen. Everything had already happened at that point. Everything was going to had happened the way it was, and you just get to learn a little bit inside of yourself. And as a cool moment, again, cool episode moments, cool character moments of that whole show. All right, we are out of time. We have hit the hour mark entirely. And all we did was talk about Star Trek and Babylon 5.
It's all right.
We didn't even get a chance to talk about your new stuff. And now that you live in Austin and stuff like that.
So yeah, I live in Austin now.
We may have to get you back on again.
Yeah,
and talk about that.
I am nearby.
Hi, man.
Wednesdays are good.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Let's say people want to argue about their opinion of Babylon 5 and Deep Space Nine and say, you're totally, totally wrong about everything you've said.
Yeah, @TensorGuy on Twitter. And I might open a new Twitter account soon, but.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I want to delve more into my experiences. I find myself as a. Almost like a spaceman visiting a new world, a new life, and I like to comment on it, and it might be boring for everybody.
Your main Twitter account,
yeah, but
you're already at that point.
Yes, but I might explore it and just look at my new life a little bit from a archaeologist or an anthropologist point of view. Because I find some things fascinating.
There's a lot. Fair enough. You do whatever it is you need to do.
So stay tuned to @TensorGuy and I might come up with something.
Well, there you go. Of course, you can find me. I'm @Vincent404 there on the Twitters. If you want to catch previous podcasts, you can go to our website, cosmicray.tv/8bitlife. There you'll find links to show notes, our Twitter account for the show, which is @8bitlifepodcast. And of course, if you want to help the show become bigger, better, and more awesomer, head over to patreon.com/8bitlife. And if you're watching the recording and you want to catch us live next time, head over to twitch.tv/cosmicradio.cosmicradiotv. Hit that big old follow button and you'll get notified whenever we go live for gaming stuff. We typically go live for the show on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Central. But there's all sorts of things happening on there. And I'll make sure you start doing a lot more game streaming there as well, so you start seeing some more content come that way. So that is it for today. Tune in next time to talk to another about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people. This has been a CosmicRadio.tv audio production. For more awesome shows, head on over to our website, CosmicRadio.tv.